This is West Southwest. I'm Sevilla Mann. We're speaking with Western Michigan University anthropologist Michael Nasaney. He's just published a book, The Archaeology of the North American Fur Trade, which draws on research from the Fort St. Joseph archaeological site in Niles. Nasaney says our understanding of the once thriving economy built on North American fur has evolved, in part due to new research, in part from reinterpreting information already gathered. I spoke with him about why he feels it's important to re-examine the fur trade. Michael Nasaney, welcome to West Southwest.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get into the particulars of the fur trade, I want to talk for a moment about fur. When this economy gets underway in the 16th century, what role does fur play in people's lives?
When we say fur, we're really referring to, it could be pelts, it could be skins, it could be hides. And in the case of the beaver, some have referred to it really as a fiber trade because it wasn't so much the long guard hairs of the beaver, but it was the little short, tiny hairs of the beaver right near the beaver's skin that was shaved off and collected and made into a felt. It was felted, and this is what beaver hats were made of. And of course, these were all the rage throughout most of Europe and of course here in the Americas as well. Throughout the 17th and 18th centuries. And it was only in the 19th century when that felt became replaced by other fabrics did beaver go into decline.
They have furry animals in Europe too. Why the need for fur from the Americas?
Well, they had furry animals in the Northwest for the most part. They were pretty much hunted out. And as early as the 11th and 12th century, Europeans were looking to points east and obtaining furs from Russians and from other Slavic groups in Eastern Europe, you know, what is now Russia. What's interesting is that expansion and search for furs extended east from Europe. And of course, it extended then west from Europe into North America, and it ultimately meets up in Alaska in the 18th century and becomes a truly global phenomenon.
Is there a way to quantify how important this economy was to the overall North American economy at the time it was in play?
Yeah, I haven't done that kind of economic analysis, but I have argued in the book that there are no archaeological sites in North America. There were no groups of people who were not impacted by the fur trade for some 400 years. So even if people weren't directly involved as fur traders, or, of course, the native peoples were the primary producers. They were the ones who were actually hunting the animals and processing the furs to be exchanged to Europeans for imported goods like kettles and cloth and iron implements and so forth. In addition to those roles that those people played directly in the fur trade, there are all sorts of spin-offs, if you will. So, for example, the Russell Cutlery Company in Massachusetts, founded in the 1830s. Those knives were ostensibly used by the mountain men in the western part of North America in the trade that they were involved in. The place settings of ceramics that were found on the tables of Boston, Philadelphia, New York elites before and after the revolution were brought from China, and those goods in China were ultimately acquired through the exchange of furs.
What about goods coming from Europe? What was coming back into the Americas in exchange for this fur?
One of the things that the producers in Europe were as interested in, of course, is they were seeking cheaper raw materials like furs, but they were also looking for markets to dispose of the goods that they were producing. So when we think of the Industrial Revolution, for example, in England in the 18th century and the production of textiles, the English peasantry or the English working class could only be sold so much in the way of textiles. So the challenge was to distribute this more broadly. And indeed, opening up markets was part and parcel of what they sought to do. So the main products, for a long time, people, archaeologists among them, thought that the main goods being traded were objects like copper kettles and iron implements like axes and knives and hoes and so forth. And indeed, these were exchanged, and alcohol, they thought, and these were exchanged. But when trade lists are actually quantified, while we see those types of objects, those durable goods, in the archaeological record, what we actually find when we look at trade lists and quantify them is that cloth was invariably the most important item that was being exchanged.
What were the relationships like between Native Americans and Europeans who were involved in this fur trade?
Yeah, and this is what I try to focus on in the book, is the nature of the relationships. And this is what drew me into the work, is trying to understand the relationships between Native peoples and Europeans. And simplistically, perhaps, it's quite variable, depending on whether one is English or French or Dutch or Spanish, and if one is encountering the Cherokee or the Potawatomi or the Narragansett or the Mi'kmaq, the outcomes were quite variable. Generally speaking, though, the English had more of a sort of a business-like manner to their view of the trade. They were hesitant to provide Native peoples with unnecessary, what they might have seen as unnecessary gifts. And so they saw the trade as more as an economic, mercantilist transaction. And that was partly because they were, in some places, numerically superior to Native peoples. But in the case of the French strategy, because there was far fewer French people, was to establish close alliances with Native peoples, often to intermarry, and often to provide gifts in advance of serious trading and so forth. And so, in a sense, you can say it was more of a social and a political relationship than it was an economic one, although the fur trade was the glue of the relationship that bound these two groups together in their alliance.
Did that stay fairly consistent between the start of the fur trade and the end of it, that perhaps more political relationship between French traders and Native Americans?
Well, in the case of the French, there was pretty close relationships with Native peoples throughout their regime in North America. Of course, they're defeated at the end of the Seven Years' War in the 1760s, and places like Fort St. Joseph and Michilimackinac, other places in Michigan, are then taken over by the English. And it's quite interesting because in this case, in the case of these particular places, the British did implement their policy. They thought it encouraged laziness on the part of natives to give them gunpowder and musket balls and these sorts of things, or a little alcohol to ease the trading relationship. They were not prone to doing that. And in fact, the Native peoples who were used to that treatment under the French basically rose up and attacked a number of the sites, including Fort St. Joseph, Michilimackinac, Detroit, in what we now know as Pontiac's Rebellion. And so this was a tactical error on the part of the English and ultimately might have contributed to their demise even up into the American Revolution.
Another thing that you address in the book is the difference between how we're looking at, interpreting, understanding the fur trade now and how it's been presented in the past. And there's a part where you describe a kind of postcard stereotype version of the fur trade as it was maybe once presented. And of course, the entire book is moving away from that. So what is that kind of, two-dimensional version of the fur trade that we've been presented with sometimes in the past?
It's a stereotypical caricature of this French-Canadian voyageur with his native wife in a canoe, you know, singing merry songs and so on, with his tassel tossed to one side, the tassel of his hat tossed to one side of his head, canoeing along a idyllic river somewhere in North America. In essence, that was really replaced. There is a kernel of truth there, if you will, insofar as there were close relationships between French voyageurs and Native hosts and Native women. I think that's very true. But with the coming of the English, with the Anglo presence and with an Anglo narrative, this voyageur was seen as a bit too frivolous. And this was really discounted to a great extent. And instead, the values of the more individualistic mountain men of the 1850s and 60s, I think, is what sort of resonates more with in the American legacy and so on.
This is West Southwest. I'm Sevilla Mann. We're speaking with Michael Nasaney, whose book, The Archaeology of the North American Fur Trade, has just come out. Nasaney says ongoing research calls into question the way the fur trade has often been portrayed.
That narrative, which still probably exists in museum exhibits and maybe in the popular imagination, is that of a history of the fur trade whereby Europeans show up with superior goods, native peoples welcome the goods, and they ultimately assimilate or they are displaced by Europeans. What the archaeology shows us when we look a little bit more carefully at the types of goods that native peoples are adopting is that, first off, they're very selective in what they're choosing to acquire. So they're not interested in just any frivolous object that Europeans are looking to sell. They have specifications for the colors of cloth. They have specifications for the quality of kettles, the gauge of the metal and so forth, and likewise with the colors of glass beads and so on. So they have clear desires, and so they're seeking objects that basically fit into their native cosmologies and native belief systems. The other thing we see is that oftentimes it's not so much European goods that they're really interested in, particularly in the early period, but it's more so European goods as raw materials. So they're taking the objects, things like kettles, for example, and they're not using them the way they were intended to be used by their makers. Instead, they're cutting them up into little shapes that they can use as ornaments. They're scoring them and producing arrow points out of the metal and so on. They're taking the barrels of guns and flattening them and using them as scrapers for hides and so on. So it's quite interesting when we look very closely at the objects and the way they're being modified in native hands. It suggests, in fact, that native peoples had their own designs for these objects, and it implies that, indeed, they had agency. They were trying to determine their own histories and live within the ways that they were familiar rather than just simply adopting European practices.
What are some of the objects or records that you found at Fort St. Joseph, and how have they shaped your understanding of the fur trade and those relationships it contained?
One of the objects that's quite provocative is a thimble, and we have found several thimbles. And of course, most of your listeners know what thimbles were used for in sewing and so on, and they were certainly used that way. But we found one that was perforated.
Which wouldn't do you much good if you were using it to protect your thumb while you sew.
Exactly. And so that suggests to us, and the context that it was found in, near these little pits that we use for smoking hides, suggests to us that there's something else going on there. And we have seen examples in museums of native garments from, for example, from the 19th century, where these thimbles have been attached to clothing, a whole series of them, and they would have dangled up against each other and made a pleasing sort of tinkling sound and so on. And so this is a complete reconceptualization of the way in which thimbles were meant to be used and so on. So that's one of the specific artifacts. More generally at the site, what we're seeing is evidence of artifacts that are inspired by native practices or were similar to objects that natives had produced even before the French were there, commingled with artifacts that were imported. So that suggests to us that the area we've been working on the site probably represents, and we've identified four or five structures in that area, these buildings are probably the buildings of fur traders and their native wives. So it suggests to us the very close relationships that existed between the French and the native people. Of course, the native people also lived directly across the river from the fort. And so when we think of a fort, we think of it as a defensive structure. But in this instance, it probably was meant really in a more symbolic way. It probably couldn't be defended since there were only about 50 or so French living there at its peak population, and there were upwards of 1,000 native peoples living in close proximity. So the best defense was establishing close relationships, and that was probably the best defense against any animosities that could arise.
When was Fort St. Joseph established, and when did it reach its heyday?
The beginnings of Fort St. Joseph, or at least where the site is today, in the 1680s, the Jesuits were granted a tract of land there to establish their mission. And the fort was officially established in 1691. It was occupied sporadically for the first couple of decades because of some political instabilities. But after about 1700 or so, there was a permanent French presence there. By about the 1720s, 1730s, we know there was a commandant. There were about 8 officers. There were 8 to 10 soldiers, enlisted men. There was a blacksmith. We know him by name. We know where he was working. We found some of the objects from his workshop. There was an interpreter. There was a priest who visited the site from time to time. There were about 15 fur traders, and their native French-Canadian, as well as French wives and children. So there were some 50 or 60 people living at Fort St. Joseph in the 1730s and 40s. So that was probably about as large as the site ever became. After the English took the site over and it was attacked during Pontiac's Rebellion, the English didn't re-garrison the site. French fur traders stayed there until 1781, when it was finally abandoned. Some of the fur traders were actually deported to Michilimackinac around that time. Of course, one of the chapters in Fort St. Joseph's history was its attack by Spanish forces from the St. Louis area. But in some ways, this is merely a footnote and really has very little impact on any of the fur trade work that we've been doing.
The fur trade itself did endure into the 19th century. Is that correct?
It did, even in the area of the St. Joseph River Valley. What's interesting is some authors have argued, and I would have to agree with them, it's true that in some areas, animal populations were decimated, and so the fur trade just couldn't continue there. But in other areas, these animal populations were capable of rebounding fairly quickly. What had happened is was native peoples were removed, and so the primary producers were gone, and that's what ultimately led to the decline of the trade. But here, for instance, in the Kalamazoo River Valley, in the St. Joseph River Valley, in the Grand River, there was the American Fur Company was in operation well into the 1840s and 50s and so on.
Is there an object you're hoping to find or some kind of question that you're hoping some element of the site will help you answer?
Well, it's really more the latter, right? The questions than it is the objects, right? Because as archaeologists, the objects are merely the forms of evidence that allow us to answer questions. And the questions we have really have to do with what was going on there and who was doing it, right? And that's what we're able to get a handle on by looking at these buildings, by paying attention to the locations of artifacts. Early in our excavations, we encountered the small concentration of gun parts. And about, well, not such a small concentration, perhaps, about 150 gun parts. And almost certainly, this is the workshop of one of the gunsmiths, perhaps Antoine de Etre, who was working at the site in the 1730s and 1740s. So the kind of insight that a deposit like that provides is it allows us to see what he's making, what he's fixing, and so on, and to juxtapose that with documentary sources that we have about his activities. Because oftentimes, what gets written down and what people are actually doing aren't one and the same. And so this is the way the archaeology can really clarify the historical documents and really provide us greater insight into what life was like in the 18th century at Fort St. Joseph and in the fur trade.
Michael Nasaney, thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Michael Nasaney is a professor of anthropology at Western Michigan University. His book, The Archaeology of the North American Fur Trade, has just been published. You can hear a longer version of this interview on our website, wmuk.org. This is West Southwest. I'm Sevilla Mann.